Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Mass demonstrations and backlash continue in Bolivia. The country is in a state of chaos after former President Evo Morales stepped down earlier this week. He fled to Mexico City, where he says he's in exile. He spoke at a news conference on Wednesday.
Me duele mucho. Hemos construido con mucho esfuerzo.
He says, it hurts me a lot. We've built so much with a lot of effort. Now they're easily destroying so much. The political upheaval in Bolivia also comes at a crucial time all over Latin America. Authoritarian regimes maintain power in Venezuela and in Nicaragua. Brazilians elected an extreme right-wing president, and there's also been protests in Chile. I spoke with WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett and Joshua Goodman, Latin America correspondent for the Associated Press, based in Miami.
Tim, let me ask you first. Morales has called this resignation a coup. Was it a coup?
That's really debatable, because while you did have the military high command in Bolivia, quote, asking him to resign, this didn't play out in the conventional sense of a coup, where you had the military, you know, pointing, the barrels of their rifles at him, telling him you have to go into exile. And that's where this is really becomes very interesting. It's almost as if he wanted them to tell him to go into exile, because if he goes into exile to Mexico as he is now, it really makes him more of sort of a people's martyr. As I think he wants to see himself at this point, rather than it sort of helps deflect attention away from all of the reasons that people were protesting against him in the streets in the first place, having his electoral tribunal try to steal an election for him.
Was he forced into exile, though? Was he forced there or face some kind of penalty or arraignment or sentence?
There's really no indication that he was forced into exile. It's almost as if he made that decision on his own. I think you can make the case that the military did lean on him to resign because they wanted to bring some stability back to the streets, as they said. But there is really no indication we're seeing that they told him, you have to leave the country.
In your commentary this week, you talked about his, quote, savior complex that he developed over time. This was, and his election was quite a beacon of hope the country 10, 12 years ago.
Actually, 14 years ago. And he was the first indigenous president of Bolivia. And you have to really appreciate how significant that was. I mean, for 500 years, the indigenous population of Bolivia had just been beaten down as much as you can imagine. And for him then to have emerged as the president of this country, the historic gravitas was just really significant. And what he did as president early on, nationalizing the natural gas resources, and that helped lift a lot of those indigenous people out of poverty. So there was a lot to applaud and cheer in his presidency. But as I said, the underbelly of all that was his savior complex, because he was the first indigenous president. He thought of himself, I think, more and more as sort of a demigod.
So what led to the downfall? What are the dominoes that wound up falling over the last week or so that led to this his resignation and this self-imposed exile?
It actually starts 2 years ago when he got his lapdog Supreme Court to rule that not letting him run for president for the rest of his life if he wanted to was, quote, a violation of his human rights, which is pretty laughable. So he essentially snubbed a referendum in Bolivia that said, no, you have to stick to the two-term limit. So then he runs again last month for president. And when the election results start to look like it's not going to let him win in the first round, the computers shut down and presto, they come back on and suddenly he's won the first round. Nobody was buying it. And that's when we saw the streets fill up with protesters and very violent protests.
You are listening to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN, talking about political change of power in Bolivia and how that's resonating throughout Latin America and the hemisphere, and some of the implications back here in the United States and South Florida. WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett is along with us. Joshua Goodman also is here. He is a Latin America correspondent for the Associated Press, now based in Miami. Josh, lots at stake in Bolivia in this transfer of power, what is hoped to be a peaceful transfer of power, certainly, for the folks in Bolivia. What are the broader kind of implications that are at play for the rest of the continent and kind of Latin America U.S. relations?
I think there's a real problem throughout Latin America, whether it's on the left or the right, of in accepting the transition of power, accepting defeat, accepting the rules of law, the game rules that everyone needs to abide by. This scenario, I know it's being celebrated by people in Washington. It's being celebrated by Morales' opponents on the right. It is not a good thing for Bolivia to have to be going through this now. The democracy is going to emerge weaker because basically the institutions have been tested and basically been shown to be pretty paper thin. So right now, I mean, you know, it's going to go on. Obviously, the country has a future. Countries just don't die. But it's going to be easier the next time for someone to do this again, whether it's Bolivia, whether it's Paraguay, whether it's Venezuela. Basically, the rule of law is being compromised, and that's a worrisome trend.
No, and that's why I wrote that really I thought it would have been better for the military in Bolivia to actually tell Morales to stay put, stay in office, finish your term while we hold a special election, which you cannot participate in. Mm-hmm. And then when
you can't run,
when he can't run,
right.
And which he shouldn't have been able to last month
right.
either. And then when that winner is elected, you hand the presidential sash to that person at the end of your term. That would have been so much better for Bolivian democracy. And to tell you the truth, it would have been far more humiliating for Evo, because he would have been doing the democratic thing instead of the demigod thing.
Lots has been happening politically in Latin America in a very short period of time. The election in Argentina, it wasn't so long ago there was the election in Brazil, and of course the utter collapse of Venezuela has been in stark focus here in South Florida. How is this kind of Bolivia situation, Josh, looked at internally within the continent?
You know, there's basically a crisis of incumbents. It doesn't matter if you're left or right in Latin America right now. The region as a whole did very well economically over the past 15 years. And then, you know, around 2015, the commodity prices started slipping. And that really thrust everyone into a bit of an economic stupor. I think, you know, going forward, the region has a serious problem. It needs to get over this sort of revanchist politics that we see all the time. It's sort of like a soccer match. You know, Latin Americans love soccer and they're very passionate and they love to humiliate their opponent on the field and the fans off the field. I remember taking a Latin American to a baseball game once here, the Yankees Red Sox game. They couldn't believe that the fans sit next to each other. So this is an endemic problem that the region's politicians on both the left and right need to get over. The left, it has to be said, was making something of a comeback, I have to say. I mean, the victory of AMLO in Mexico, Fernandez returning to power despite all of the allegations against her, is pretty impressive. And it just goes to show that, you know, these political cultures, I think they are sort of, the political center is more tilted to the left, because basically the left has been very effective, something, you know, the conservatives have not done well in talking about the real, the real dollar, you know, inequality issues that really, affect people's, you know, lifestyle. What's happened, though, is interestingly, is that the left basically were the ones responsible for bringing these issues to the fore 15 years ago. Evo Morales, certainly among the most prominent ones. And then they sort of got stuck there. And there were issues of corruption, which, you know, cut both ways as well. But their discourse didn't really evolve with their own voting base. A lot of these people, you know, I know many people who are sending their kids to college for the first time have, their families, the first time in centuries that their families are paying taxes. When they start to do that and they see, you know, how expensive these taxes are, they're the same tax rates as in the United States, sometimes even higher. And see what poor services they get in exchange, they begin to ask, hey, where's our money going?
What's that public dialogue like on the continent when households are thinking about that return on investment that they're making in that public spending?
I mean, you know, they blame the guy in office who's stolen it, basically, whether that's left or right. So I really think it's misguided by a lot of people to judge this on an ideological lens. People in Latin America are just fed up, and, you know, both parts of the ideological spectrum have basically failed their populations in delivering basic services, healthcare, education, good roads. I just moved back here, as you mentioned, and I can tell you, I pay the same amount of taxes in Latin America as I pay in the United States, but the level of services, and I know there's a lot of deficiencies in U.S. services as well, but the level is quite abysmal between the two.
Tim, you've written about this in terms of kind of the sophistication, the evolution of the Latin America economy and the political system, and how it is relating to the investment, not in just public services, but in public education, in healthcare, in infrastructure. When we see transit fare increases leading to hundreds of thousands of Chileans, and just a few years ago, hundreds of thousands of Brazilians taking to the streets. The boom and the bust cycle based upon the commodity-intensive economies of this region.
What you're seeing on the streets of Latin America right now is what I call the anger of expectations. I mean, as Josh aptly pointed out, for most of the first, at least the first decade of this century and part of this decade, you really did see a lot of prosperity. Commodity prices were high. People rose into the middle class, especially in places like Brazil. But what that does is it creates expectations for, as we've been pointing out, better services. And also, not just better services, but a more sophisticated, a more modern economic model. It's ironic that those commodity prices led to people's better prosperity, but then when they get more prosperous and they get smarter about things, they realize, wow, we've got one heck of an archaic economic system in Latin America based on just raw materials. Mm-hmm. We don't really make anything that the rest of the world wants. And this system is so vulnerable to these volatile global prices for things like oil and soybeans and
copper and gold.
Copper and ore and things like that. So I think what you're seeing is the problem with Latin American leaders is that they think that when people get richer, they don't get smarter. They do. And they're demanding a more modern way of doing things. They're not seeing it, and so they're taking to the streets.
I was just going to add, there's a real disconnect between the polarizing politics of the region and people's expectations. You know, when you look at these countries, and except for the countries where voting is obligatory, their voting rates are lower than the United States, 45, 50%. Most people are just trying to get by, do their things for their families, and improve their lot in life. They don't, but the politicians and the left, especially, I think, in this regard, have really maintained a sort of strident anti-American rhetoric that really, I think, is just completely out of whack.
Does that play out in the households? Does it reflect what's happening?
I just think people are disinterested in these politicians, and these the core supporters of the left, which are always 20-30%, and are, you know, that's a strong amount in any country, or the right. In Colombia, you have a strong 20-30% right wing voting public. These people then dominate the politics without really speaking to the zeitgeist of the overall people.
What about the role of the United States? Let's start with the situation right now that's so active in Bolivia. Is there any active engagement? Do we know what kind of impression this is making in Washington?
Well, the Trump administration is applauding Jeanine Áñez, for example, the opposition senator who has, we think, assumed the interim presidency in Bolivia while all this chaos goes on. There's a big question as to whether she really is the interim president, but Washington is congratulating her and Bolivia and the military for getting Evo to step aside and return democracy to Bolivia. The risk, though, is that the United States is going to be seen as sort of backing a right wing, as we were saying at the outset, coup. And that's the tightrope that Washington needs, that the Trump administration has to walk right now.
Josh, from the perspective on the ground, how is this engagement being seen? Is it seen generally through the lens, especially of regarding Venezuela, which has been obviously the hot point for U.S. Latin American relations for this administration?
Yeah, I mean, explicitly, the White House put out a statement saying Nicaragua and Venezuela, they didn't mention Cuba, interestingly, you're next. The U.S. celebrating this, it's interesting. I think this is a double-edged sword for the U.S. Obviously, this does play to the U.S. interests in the region. They are hopeful that the next government will be much more interested in building Bolivia's institutions. However, I mean, many people will see this as very partisan, that basically Washington supports conservative governments and that who knows, maybe one the next president elected in Bolivia will be from Morales's party. We don't know that, just like it could happen in Venezuela if we get to new elections in Venezuela. And this picking of governments is, I think, generally loathed by Latin Americans.
Josh, you mentioned something interesting there. Lots of different things, but one is that White House statement after the Bolivian experience here. So much of the oxygen in Washington, of course, is focused on impeachment here, Tim. Mm-hmm. Venezuela has moved back beyond the back burner and off the stove, some would argue entirely, yeah, when it comes to foreign policy here, because it's all about Ukraine and what has happened with the phone call. So where is the status when we think about U.S. interests in Venezuela?
It's pretty muted right now. This week, for example, the opposition, quote, ambassador for Venezuela in Washington got together with the South Florida congressional delegation, Wasserman Schultz, Diaz-Balart, and they created, or they launched this new caucus that they're calling the Venezuela Democracy Caucus, which is supposed to give expats a stronger voice in Washington in the effort to restore democracy in Venezuela. No one was talking about it at all.
The only thing that came, well, I shouldn't say the only thing, but some of the biggest news that came out of that was the a physical kerfuffle by a supporter,
right,
purportedly, of Nicolas Maduro, the dictator in Venezuela, and Congressman Wasserman Schultz.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so really it is, you know, as you said, impeachment is taking all the oxygen out of the room here. And the effort, I think it really gives the Trump administration a sort of a shot in the arm in Latin America to see Evo resign and go into exile. But I'll tell you, they were just as surprised as the rest of us to see Evo resign. And when they come out with this bluster that Venezuela and Cuba are next, no, I think that's almost sort of a reckless raising of expectations for Venezuelans in that regard.
I would agree. I would only add, though, that for the opposition, you know, which were, they needed a jolt in the arm.
Sure.
And for them, this is a, you know, slightly encouraging, but they still have a very uphill battle. What Evo did in Bolivia is very different from how Maduro runs Venezuela. You know, he has complete control of the military. You're not going to see any generals.
Maduro does. Right. Yeah,
you're not going to see any of the top command coming out with a rifle to his.
Yeah, months ago, the focus of Congressman Diaz-Balart, Senator Rubio, and others were a focus on some key generals in Venezuela holding kind of the fate of the Maduro regime.
Right. And they still do. Yeah. And they still will, because as Josh pointed out, the dynamics are much different. The generals in Venezuela have a much deeper stake in keeping that authoritarian socialist regime in place. That wasn't the case in Bolivia.
And the argument is an illegitimate stake.
Yes,
oftentimes.
Right. Given the allegations of drug trafficking, right, that hang over them, et cetera.
Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN, and Joshua Goodman, Latin America correspondent for the Associated Press based in Miami. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.